Esther managed to solve her problem from the comfort of her sweet spot. Yet sometimes stretching beyond it is our only choice. Some years ago, I decided that I wanted to conquer my fear of public speaking. After much hemming and hawing, I signed up for a workshop at the Public Speaking Social Anxiety Center of New York. I had my doubts. I felt like a garden variety shy person, and I didn't like the pathological sound of the term social anxiety. But the class was based on desensitization training, an approach that made sense to me. Often used as a way to conquer phobias, desensitization involves exposing yourself and your amygdala to the thing you're afraid of over and over again in manageable doses. This is very different from the well-meaning but unhelpful advice that you should just jump in at the deep end and try to swim, an approach that might work, but more likely will produce panic, further encoding in your brain a cycle of dread, fear, and shame. I found myself in good company. There were about 15 people in the class, which was led by Charles DeCagno, a wiry, compact man with warm brown eyes and a sophisticated sense of humor. Charles is himself a veteran of exposure therapy. Public speaking anxiety doesn't keep him up at night anymore, he says, but fear is a wily enemy, and he's always working to get the better of it. The workshop had been in session for a few weeks before I joined, but Charles assured me that newcomers were welcome. The group was more diverse than I expected. There was a fashion designer with long curly hair, bright lipstick, and pointy snakeskin boots, a secretary with thick glasses and a clipped matter-of-fact manner who talked a lot about her Mensa membership, a couple of investment bankers, tall and athletic, an actor with black hair and vivid blue eyes who bounded cheerfully across the room in his Puma sneakers but claimed to be terrified the entire time, a Chinese software designer with a sweet smile and a nervous laugh. A regular cross-section of New Yorkers, really. It might have been a class in digital photography or Italian cooking, except that it wasn't. Charles explained that each of us would speak in front of the group, but at an anxiety level we could handle. A martial arts instructor named Letitia was first up that evening. Letitia's assignment was to read aloud to the class from a Robert Frost poem. With her dreadlocks and wide smile, Letitia looked as if she wasn't afraid of anything. But as she got ready to speak, her book propped open at the podium, Charles asked how anxious she was on a scale of 1 to 10. "At least 7, said Letitia. "Take it slow," he said. "There are only a few people out there who can completely overcome their fears, and they all live in Tibet." Letitia read the poem clearly and quietly, with only the slightest tremor in her voice. When she was finished, Charles beamed proudly. "Stand up, please, Lisa," he said, addressing an attractive young marketing director with shiny black hair and a gleaming engagement ring. "It's your turn to offer feedback. Did Letitia look nervous?" "No," said Lisa. "I was really scared, though," Letitia said. "Don't worry, no one could tell," Lisa assured her. The others nodded their heads vigorously. "Couldn't tell at all," they echoed. Letitia sat down, looking pleased. Next it was my turn. I stood at a makeshift podium, really a music stand, and faced the group. The only sound in the room was the ticking of the ceiling fan and the blare of traffic outside. Charles asked me to introduce myself. I took a deep breath. "Hello," I shouted, hoping to sound dynamic. Charles looked alarmed. "Just be yourself," he said. My first exercise was simple. All I had to do was answer a few questions that people called out. "Where do you live? What do you do for a living? What did you do this weekend?" I answered the questions in my normal, soft-spoken way. The group listened carefully. "Does anyone have any more questions for Susan?" asked Charles. The group shook their heads. "Now, Dan," said Charles, nodding at a strapping, red-haired fellow who looked like one of those CNBC journalists reporting directly from the New York Stock Exchange. "You're a banker, and you have tough standards. Tell me, did Susan look nervous?" "Not at all," said Dan. The rest of the group nodded. "Not nervous at all," they murmured, just as they had for Letitia. "You seem so outgoing," they added. "You came across as really confident." You're lucky because you never run out of things to say. I sat down feeling pretty good about myself. But soon I saw that Letitia and I weren't the only ones to get that kind of feedback. A few others did as well. You looked so calm, these speakers were told, to their visible relief. No one would ever know if they didn't know. What are you doing in this class? At first I wondered why I prized these reassurances so highly. Then I realized that I was attending the workshop because I wanted to stretch myself to the outer limits of my temperament. I wanted to be the best and bravest speaker I could be. The reassurances were evidence that I was on my way toward achieving this goal. I suspected that the feedback I was getting was overly charitable, but I didn't care. What mattered was that I'd addressed an audience that had received me well, and I felt good about the experience. I had begun to desensitize myself to the horrors of public speaking. Since then, I've done plenty of speaking, to groups of 10 and crowds of hundreds. I've come to embrace the power of the podium. For me, this involves taking specific steps, including treating every speech as a creative project, so that when I get ready for the big day, I experience that delving deep sensation I enjoy so much. I also speak on topics that matter to me deeply, and have found that I feel much more centered when I truly care about my subject. This isn't always possible, of course. Sometimes speakers need to talk about subjects that don't interest them much, especially at work. I believe this is harder for introverts, who have trouble projecting artificial enthusiasm. But there's a hidden advantage to this inflexibility. It can motivate us to make tough but worthwhile career changes if we find ourselves compelled to speak too often about topics that leave us cold. There is no one more courageous than the person who speaks with the courage of his convictions. Chapter 6. Franklin was a politician, but Eleanor spoke out of conscience. Why cool is overrated. A shy man, no doubt, dreads the notice of strangers, but can hardly be said to be afraid of them. He may be as bold as a hero in battle, and yet have no self-confidence about trifles in the presence of strangers. Charles Darwin. Easter Sunday, 1939. The Lincoln Memorial. Marian Anderson, one of the most extraordinary singers of her generation, takes the stage, the statue of the 16th president rising up behind her. A regal woman with toffee-colored skin, she gazes at her audience of 75,000. Men in brimmed hats, ladies in their Sunday best, a great sea of black and white faces. "My country, 'tis of thee," she begins, her voice soaring, each word pure and distinct. "Sweet land of liberty." The crowd is rapt and tearful. They never thought this day would come to pass. And it wouldn't have, without Eleanor Roosevelt. Earlier that year, Anderson had planned to sing at Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C., but the Daughters of the American Revolution, who owned the hall, rejected her because of her race. Eleanor Roosevelt, whose family had fought in the Revolution, resigned from the D.A.R., helped arrange for Anderson to sing at the Lincoln Memorial, and ignited a national firestorm. Roosevelt was not the only one to protest, but she brought political clout to the issue, risking her own reputation in the process. For Roosevelt, who seemed constitutionally unable to look away from other people's troubles, such acts of social conscience were nothing unusual. But others appreciated how remarkable they were. This was something unique, recalled the African-American civil rights leader James Farmer of Roosevelt's brave stand. Franklin was a politician. He weighed the political consequences of every step that he took. He was a good politician, too. But Eleanor spoke out of conscience and acted as a conscientious person. That was different. It was a role she played throughout their life together. Franklin's advisor, Franklin's conscience. He may have chosen her for just this reason. In other ways, they were such an unlikely pair. They met when he was 20. Franklin was her distant cousin, a sheltered Harvard senior from an upper-crust family. Eleanor was only 19, also from a moneyed clan, but she had chosen to immerse herself in the sufferings of the poor, despite her family's disapproval. As a volunteer at a settlement house on Manhattan's impoverished Lower East Side, she had met children who were forced to sew artificial flowers in windowless factories to the point of exhaustion. She took Franklin with her one day. He couldn't believe that human beings lived in such miserable conditions, or that a young woman of his own class had been the one to open his eyes to this side of America. He promptly fell in love with her. But Eleanor wasn't the light, witty type he'd been expected to marry. Just the opposite. She was slow to laugh, bored by small talk, serious-minded, shy. Her mother, a fine-boned, vivacious aristocrat, had nicknamed her Granny because of her demeanor. Her father, the charming and popular younger brother of Theodore Roosevelt, doted on her when he saw her, but he was drunk most of the time and died when Eleanor was 9. By the time Eleanor met Franklin, she couldn't believe that someone like him would be interested in her. Franklin was everything that she was not, bold and buoyant, with a wide, irrepressible grin, as easy with people as she was cautious. He was young and gay and good-looking, Eleanor recalled, and I was shy and awkward and thrilled when he asked me to dance. At the same time, many told Eleanor that Franklin wasn't good enough for her. Some saw him as a lightweight, a mediocre scholar, a frivolous man about town. And however poor Eleanor's own self-image, she did not lack for admirers who appreciated her gravitas. Some of her suitors wrote grudging letters of congratulations to Franklin when he won her hand. "I have more respect and admiration for Eleanor than any girl I have ever met," one letter writer said. "You are mighty lucky. Your future wife is such as it is the privilege of few men to have," said another. But public opinion was beside the point for Franklin and Eleanor. Each had strengths that the other craved. Her empathy, his bravado. "E is an angel," Franklin wrote in his journal. When she accepted his marriage proposal in 1903, he proclaimed himself the happiest man alive. She responded with a flood of love letters. They were married in 1905 and went on to have 6 children. Despite the excitement of their courtship, their differences caused trouble from the start. Eleanor craved intimacy and weighty conversations. He loved parties, flirting, and gossip. The man who would declare that he had nothing to fear but fear itself could not understand his wife's struggles with shyness. When Franklin was appointed Assistant Secretary of the Navy in 1913, the pace of his social life grew ever more frenzied and the settings more gilded, elite private clubs, his Harvard friends' mansions. He caroused later and later into the night. Eleanor went home earlier and earlier. In the meantime, Eleanor found herself with a full calendar of social duties. She was expected to pay visits to the wives of other Washington luminaries, leaving calling cards at their doors and holding open houses in her own home. She didn't relish this role, so she hired a social secretary named Lucy Mercer to help her, which seemed a good idea, until the summer of 1917, when Eleanor took the children to Maine for the summer, leaving Franklin behind in Washington with Mercer. The two began a lifelong affair. Lucy was just the kind of lively beauty Franklin had been expected to marry in the first place. Eleanor found out about Franklin's betrayal when she stumbled on a packet of love letters in his suitcase. She was devastated, but stayed in the marriage. And although they never rekindled the romantic side of their relationship, she and Franklin replaced it with something formidable, a union of his confidence with her conscience. Fast forward to our own time, where we'll meet another woman of similar temperament, acting out her own sense of conscience. Dr. Elaine Aron is a research psychologist who, since her first scientific publication in 1997, has single-handedly reframed what Jerome Kagan and others call high reactivity, and sometimes negativity or inhibition. She calls it sensitivity, and along with her new name for the trait, she's transformed and deepened our understanding of it. When I hear that Aron will be the keynote speaker at an annual weekend gathering of highly sensitive people at Walker Creek Ranch in Marin County, California, I quickly buy plane tickets. Jacqueline Strickland, a psychotherapist and the founder and host of the event, explains that she created these weekends so that sensitive people could benefit from being in one another's presence. She sends me an agenda explaining that we'll be sleeping in rooms designated for napping, journaling, puttering, meditating, organizing, writing, and reflecting. Please do socialize very quietly in your room, with consent of your roommate, or preferably in the group areas on walks and at mealtimes, says the agenda. The conference is geared to people who enjoy meaningful discussions and sometimes move a conversation to a deeper level, only to find out we are the only ones there. There will be plenty of time for serious talk this weekend, we're assured. But we'll also be free to come and go as we please. Strickland knows that most of us will have weathered a lifetime of mandatory group activities, and she wants to show us a different model, if only for a few days. Walker Creek Ranch sits on 1,741 acres of unspoiled Northern California wilderness. It offers hiking trails and wildlife and vast crystalline skies. But at its center is a cozy barn-like conference center where about 30 of us gather on a Thursday afternoon in the middle of June. The Buckeye Lodge is outfitted with gray industrial carpets, large whiteboards, and picture windows overlooking sunny redwood forests. Alongside the usual piles of registration forms and name badges, there's a flip chart where we're asked to write our name and Myers-Briggs personality type. I scan the list. Everyone's an introvert except for Strickland, who is warm, welcoming, and expressive. According to Aaron's research, the majority, though not all, of sensitive people are introverts. The tables and chairs in the room are organized in a big square so that we can all sit and face one another. Strickland invites us, participation optional, to share what brought us here. A software engineer named Tom kicks off, describing with great passion his relief at learning that there was a physiological basis for the trait of sensitivity. Here's the research. This is how I am. I don't have to try to meet anyone's expectations anymore. I don't need to feel apologetic or defensive in any way. With his long, narrow face, brown hair, and matching beard, Tom reminds me of Abraham Lincoln. He introduces his wife, who talks about how compatible she and Tom are, and how together they stumbled across Aaron's work. When it's my turn, I talk about how I've never been in a group environment in which I didn't feel obliged to present an unnaturally rah-rah version of myself. I say that I'm interested in the connection between introversion and sensitivity. Many people nod. On Saturday morning, Dr. Aaron appears in the Buckeye Lodge. She waits playfully behind an easel containing a flip chart while Strickland introduces her to the audience. Then she emerges smiling, ta-da, from behind the easel, sensibly clad in a blazer, turtleneck, and corduroy skirt. She has short, feathery brown hair and warm, crinkly blue eyes that look as if they don't miss a thing. You could see immediately the dignified scholar Aaron is today, as well as the awkward schoolgirl she must once have been. You can see, too, her respect for her audience. Getting right down to business, she informs us that she has 5 different subtopics she can discuss and asks us to raise our hands to vote for our first, second, and third choice of subjects. Then she performs rapid fire, an elaborate mathematical calculation from which she determines the 3 subtopics for which we've collectively voted. The crowd settles down amiably. It doesn't really matter which subtopics we've chosen. We know that Aaron is here to talk about sensitivity and that she's taking our preferences into consideration. Some psychologists make their mark by doing unusual research experiments. Aaron's contribution is to think differently, radically differently, about studies that others have done. When she was a girl, Aaron was often told that she was too sensitive for her own good. She had 2 hardy elder siblings and was the only child in her family who liked to daydream and play inside and whose feelings were easily hurt. As she grew older and ventured outside her family's orbit, She continued to notice things about herself that seemed different from the norm. She could drive alone for hours and never turn on the radio. She had strong, sometimes disturbing dreams at night. She was strangely intense and often beset by powerful emotions, both positive and negative. She had trouble finding the sacred in the everyday. It seemed to be there only when she withdrew from the world. Aaron grew up, became a psychologist, and married a robust man who loved these qualities. To her husband, Art, Aaron was creative, intuitive, and a deep thinker. She appreciated these things in herself, too, but saw them as acceptable surface manifestations of a terrible hidden flaw I had been aware of all my life. She thought it was a miracle that Art loved her in spite of this flaw. But when one of her fellow psychologists casually described Aaron as highly sensitive, a light bulb went on in her head. It was as if these two words described her mysterious failing, except that the psychologist hadn't been referring to a flaw at all. It had been a neutral description. Aaron pondered this new insight, and then set out to research this trait called sensitivity. She came up mostly dry, so she pored over the vast literature on introversion, which seemed to be intimately related. Kagan's work on high-reactive children and the long line of experiments on the tendency of introverts to be more sensitive to social and sensory stimulation. These studies gave her glimpses of what she was looking for, but Aaron thought that there was a missing piece in the emerging portrait of introverted people. The problem for scientists is that we try to observe behavior, and these are things that you cannot observe, she explains. Scientists can easily report on the behavior of extroverts, who can often be found laughing, talking, or gesticulating. But if a person is standing in the corner of a room, you can attribute about 15 motivations to that person, but you don't really know what's going on inside. Yet inner behavior was still behavior, thought Aaron, even if it was difficult to catalog. So what is the inner behavior of people whose most visible feature is that when you take them to a party, they aren't very pleased about it? She decided to find out. First, Aaron interviewed 39 people who described themselves as being either introverted or easily overwhelmed by stimulation. She asked them about the movies they liked, their first memories, relationships with parents, friendships, love lives, creative activities, philosophical and religious views. Based on these interviews, she created a voluminous questionnaire that she gave to several large groups of people. Then she boiled their responses down to a constellation of 27 attributes. She named the people who embodied these attributes highly sensitive. Some of these 27 attributes were familiar from Kagan and others' work. For example, highly sensitive people tend to be keen observers who look before they leap. They arrange their lives in ways that limit surprises. They're often sensitive to sights, sounds, smells, pain, coffee. They have difficulty when being observed, at work, say, or performing at a music recital, or judged for general worthiness, dating, job interviews. But there were also new insights. The highly sensitive tend to be philosophical or spiritual in their orientation, rather than materialistic or hedonistic. They dislike small talk. They often describe themselves as creative or intuitive, just as Aaron's husband had described her. They dream vividly and can often recall their dreams the next day. They love music, nature, art, physical beauty. They feel exceptionally strong emotions, sometimes acute bouts of joy, but also sorrow, melancholy, and fear. Highly sensitive people also process information about their environments, both physical and emotional, unusually deeply. They tend to notice subtleties that others miss. Another person's shift in mood, say, or a light bulb burning a touch too brightly. Recently, a group of scientists at Stony Brook University tested this finding by showing two pairs of photos of a fence and some bales of hay to 18 people lying inside fMRI machines. In one pair, the photos were noticeably different from each other, and in the other pair, the difference was much more subtle. For each pair, the scientists asked whether the second photo was the same as the first. They found that sensitive people spent more time than others looking at the photos with the subtle differences. Their brains also showed more activity in regions that helped to make associations between those images and other stored information. In other words, the sensitive people were processing the photos at a more elaborate level than their peers, reflecting more on those fence posts and haystacks. This study is very new, and its conclusions still need to be replicated and explored in other contexts. But it echoes Jerome Kagan's findings that high-reactive first graders spend more time than other children comparing choices when they play matching games or reading unfamiliar words. And it suggests, says Yadya Yagielowicz, the lead scientist at Stony Brook, that sensitive types think in an unusually complex fashion. It may also help explain why they're so bored by small talk. If you're thinking in more complicated ways, she told me, then talking about the weather or where you went for the holidays is not quite as interesting as talking about values or morality. The other thing Aaron found about sensitive people is that sometimes they're highly empathic. It's as if they have thinner boundaries separating them from other people's emotions and from the tragedies and cruelties of the world. They tend to have unusually strong consciences. They avoid violent movies and TV shows. They're acutely aware of the consequences of a lapse in their own behavior. In social settings, they often focus on subjects like personal problems, which others consider too heavy. Aaron realized that she was onto something big. Many of the characteristics of sensitive people that she'd identified, such as empathy and responsiveness to beauty, were believed by psychologists to be characteristic of other personality traits like agreeableness and openness to experience. But Aaron saw that they were also a fundamental part of sensitivity. Her findings implicitly challenged accepted tenets of personality psychology. She started publishing her results in academic journals and books and speaking publicly about her work. At first, this was difficult. Audience members told her that her ideas were fascinating, but that her uncertain delivery was distracting. But Aaron had a great desire to get her message out. She persevered and learned to speak like the authority she was. By the time I saw her at Walker Creek Ranch, she was practiced, crisp, and sure. The only difference between her and your typical speaker was how conscientious she seemed about answering every last audience question. She lingered afterward with the group, even though, as an extreme introvert, she must have been itching to get home. Aaron's description of highly sensitive people sounds as if she's talking about Eleanor Roosevelt herself. Indeed, in the years since Aaron first published her findings, scientists have found that when you put people whose genetic profiles have been tentatively associated with sensitivity and introversion, people with the gene variant of 5-HTT-LPR that characterized the rhesus monkeys of Chapter 3, inside an fMRI machine, and show them pictures of scared faces, accident victims, mutilated bodies, and polluted scenery, the amygdala, the part of the brain that plays such an important role in processing emotions, become strongly activated. Aaron and a team of scientists have also found that when sensitive people see faces of people experiencing strong feelings, they have more activation than others do in areas of the brain associated with empathy and with trying to control strong emotions. It's as if, like Eleanor Roosevelt, they can't help but feel what others feel. In 1921, FDR contracted polio. It was a terrible blow, and he considered retiring to the country to live out his life as an invalid gentleman. But Eleanor kept his contacts with the Democratic Party alive while he recovered, even agreeing to address a party fundraiser. She was terrified of public speaking and not much good at it. She had a high-pitched voice and laughed nervously at all the wrong times. But she trained for the event and made her way through the speech. After that, Eleanor was still unsure of herself, but she began working to fix the social problems she saw all around her. She became a champion of women's issues and forged alliances with other serious-minded people. By 1928, When FDR was elected governor of New York, she was the director of the Bureau of Women's Activities for the Democratic Party and one of the most influential women in American politics. She and Franklin were now a fully functioning partnership of his savoir-faire and her social conscience. "I knew about social conditions, perhaps more than he did," Eleanor recalled with characteristic modesty. "But he knew about government and how you could use government to improve things. And I think we began to get an understanding of teamwork." FDR was elected president in 1933. It was the height of the Depression, and Eleanor traveled the country in a single 3-month period. She covered 40,000 miles, listening to ordinary people tell their hard luck stories. People opened up to her in ways they didn't for other powerful figures. She became, for Franklin, the voice of the dispossessed. When she returned home from her trips, she often told him what she'd seen and pressed him to act. She helped orchestrate government programs for half-starved miners in Appalachia. She urged FDR to include women and African Americans in his programs to put people back to work. And she helped arrange for Marian Anderson to sing at the Lincoln Memorial. She kept at him on issues which he might, in the rush of things, have wanted to overlook. The historian Jeff Ward has said, "She kept him to a high standard. Anyone who ever saw her lock eyes with him and say, 'Now, Franklin, you should,' never forgot it." The shy young woman who'd been terrified of public speaking grew to love public life. Eleanor Roosevelt became the first First Lady to hold a press conference, address a national convention, write a newspaper column, and appear on talk radio. Later in her career, she served as a U.S. delegate to the United Nations, where she used her unusual brand of political skills and hard-won toughness to help win passage of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. She never did outgrow her vulnerability. All her life she suffered dark Griselda moods, as she called them, named for a princess in a medieval legend who withdrew into silence, and struggled to develop skin as tough as rhinoceros hide. "I think people who are shy remain shy always, but they learn how to overcome it," she said. But it was perhaps this sensitivity that made it easy for her to relate to the disenfranchised and conscientious enough to act on their behalf. FDR, elected at the start of the Depression, is remembered for his compassion. But it was Eleanor who made sure he knew how suffering Americans felt. The connection between sensitivity and conscience has long been observed. Imagine the following experiment, performed by the developmental psychologist Grazina Kochanska. A kind woman hands a toy to a toddler, explaining that the child should be very careful because it's one of the woman's favorites. The child solemnly nods assent and begins to play with the toy. Soon afterward, it breaks dramatically in two, having been rigged to do so. The woman looks upset and cries, "Oh my!" Then she waits to see what the child does next. Some children, it turns out, feel a lot more guilty about their supposed transgression than others. They look away, hug themselves, stammer out confessions, hide their faces. And it's the kids we might call the most sensitive, the most high reactive, the ones who are likely to be introverts who feel the guiltiest. Being unusually sensitive to all experience, both positive and negative, they seem to feel both the sorrow of the woman whose toy is broken and the anxiety of having done something bad. In case you're wondering, the woman in the experiments quickly returned to the room with the toy fixed and reassurances that the child had done nothing wrong. In our culture, guilt is a tainted word, but it's probably one of the building blocks of conscience. The anxiety these highly sensitive toddlers feel upon apparently breaking the toy gives them the motivation to avoid harming someone's plaything the next time. By age 4, according to Kochanska, these same kids are less likely than their peers to cheat or break rules, even when they think they can't be caught. And by 6 or 7, they're more likely to be described by their parents as having high levels of moral traits, such as empathy. They also have fewer behavioral problems in general. "Functional, moderate guilt," writes Kochanska, "may promote future altruism, personal responsibility, adaptive behavior in school, and harmonious, competent, and pro-social relationships with parents, teachers, and friends. This is an especially important set of attributes at a time when a 2010 University of Michigan study shows that college students today are 40% less empathetic than they were 30 years ago, with much of the drop having occurred since 2000. The study's authors speculate that the decline in empathy is related to the prevalence of social media, reality TV, and hyper-competitiveness. Of course, having these traits doesn't mean that sensitive children are angels. They have selfish streaks like everyone else. Sometimes they act aloof and unfriendly. And when they're overwhelmed by negative emotions like shame or anxiety, says Aaron, they can be positively oblivious of other people's needs. But the same receptivity to experience that can make life difficult for the highly sensitive also builds their consciences. Aaron tells of one sensitive teen who persuaded his mother to feed a homeless person he'd met in the park, and of another 8-year-old who cried not only when she felt embarrassed, but also when her peers were teased. We know this type of person well from literature, probably because so many writers are sensitive introverts themselves. He had gone through life with one skin fewer than most men. The novelist Eric Malpass writes of his quiet and cerebral protagonist, also an author, in the novel The Long, Long Dances. The troubles of others moved him more, as did also the teeming beauty of life, moved him, compelled him, to seize a pen and write about them. He was moved by walking in the hills, listening to a Schubert impromptu, watching nightly from his armchair the smashing of bone and flesh that made up so much of the 9 o'clock news. The description of such characters as thin-skinned is meant metaphorically, but it turns out that it's actually quite literal. Among the tests researchers use to measure personality traits are skin conductance tests, which record how much people sweat in response to noises, strong emotions, and other stimuli. High reactive introverts sweat more. Low reactive extroverts sweat less. Their skin is literally thicker, more impervious to stimuli, cooler to the touch. In fact, according to some of the scientists I spoke to, this is where our notion of being socially cool comes from. The lower reactive you are, the cooler your skin, the cooler you are. Incidentally, sociopaths lie at the extreme end of this coolness barometer, with extremely low levels of arousal, skin conductance, and anxiety. There is some evidence that sociopaths have damaged amygdalae. Lie detectors, polygraphs, are partially skin conductance tests. They operate on the theory that lying causes anxiety, which triggers the skin to perspire imperceptibly. When I was in college, I applied for a summer job as a secretary at a large jewelry company. I had to take a lie detector test as part of the application process. The test was administered in a small, dingily lit room with linoleum floors by a thin, cigarette-puffing man with pocked yellow skin. The man asked me a series of warm-up questions, my name, address, and so on, to establish my baseline level of skin conductance. Then the questions grew more probing, and the examiner's manner harsher. Had I been arrested? Had I ever shoplifted? Had I used cocaine? With this last question, my interrogator peered at me intently. As it happens, I never had tried cocaine, but he seemed to think I had. The accusing look on his face was the equivalent of the old policeman's trick, where they tell the suspect that they have the damning evidence and there's no point denying it. I knew the man was mistaken, but I still felt myself blush. And sure enough, the test came back showing I'd lied on the cocaine question. My skin is so thin, apparently, that it sweats in response to imaginary crimes. We tend to think of coolness as a pose that you strike with a pair of sunglasses, a nonchalant attitude, and drink in hand. But maybe we didn't choose these social accessories at random. Maybe we've adopted dark glasses, relaxed body language, and alcohol as signifiers precisely because they camouflage signs of a nervous system on overdrive. Sunglasses prevent others from seeing our eyes dilate with surprise or fear. We know from Kagan's work that a relaxed torso is a hallmark of low reactivity, and alcohol removes our inhibitions and lowers our arousal levels. When you go to a football game and someone offers you a beer, says the personality psychologist Brian Little. They're really saying, hi, have a glass of extroversion. Teenagers understand instinctively the physiology of cool. In Curtis Sittenfeld's novel, Prep, which explores the adolescent social rituals of boarding school life with uncanny precision, the protagonist, Lee, is invited unexpectedly to the dorm room of Asbeth, the coolest girl in school. The first thing she notices is how physically stimulating Asbeth's world is. From outside the door, I could hear pounding music, she observes. White Christmas lights, currently turned on, were taped high up along all the walls, and on the north wall, they'd hung an enormous orange and green tapestry. I felt overstimulated and vaguely irritated. The room I shared with my roommate seemed so quiet and plain. Our lives seemed so quiet and plain. Had Asbeth been born cool, I wondered, or had someone taught her, like an older sister or a cousin? Jock cultures sense the low reactivity physiology of cool, too. For the early U.S. astronauts, having a low heart rate, which is associated with low reactivity, was a status symbol. Lieutenant Colonel John Glenn, who became the first American to orbit the Earth and would later run for president, was admired by his comrades for his super cool pulse rate during liftoff, only 110 beats per minute. But physical lack of cool may be more socially valuable than we think. That deep blush when a hard-bitten tester puts his face an inch from yours and asks if you've ever used cocaine turns out to be a kind of social glue. In a recent experiment, a team of psychologists, led by Corinne Dyke, asked 60-odd participants to read accounts of people who'd done something morally wrong, like driving away from a car crash, or something embarrassing, like spilling coffee on someone. The participants were shown photographs of the wrongdoers, who had one of four different facial expressions: shame or embarrassment, head and eyes down, shame slash embarrassment plus a blush, neutral, or neutral with a blush. Then they were asked to rate how sympathetic and trustworthy the transgressors were. It turned out that the offenders who blushed were judged a lot more positively than those who didn't. This was because the blush signified concern for others. As Dr. Keltner, a psychologist at the University of California, Berkeley, who specializes in positive emotions, put it to the New York Times, a blush comes online in 2 or 3 seconds and says, I care. I know I violated the social contract. In fact, the very thing that many high reactives hate most about blushing, its uncontrollability, is what makes it so socially useful. Because it is impossible to control the blush intentionally, Dyke speculates, blushing is an authentic sign of embarrassment. And embarrassment, according to Keltner, is a moral emotion. It shows humility, modesty, and a desire to avoid aggression and make peace. It's not about isolating the person who feels ashamed, which is how it sometimes feels to easy blushers, but about bringing people together. Keltner has tracked the roots of human embarrassment and found that after many primates fight, they try to make up. They do this partly by making gestures of embarrassment of the kind we see in humans, looking away, which acknowledges wrongdoing and the intention to stop, lowering the head, which shrinks one's size, and pressing the lips together, a sign of inhibition. These gestures in humans have been called acts of devotion, writes Keltner. Indeed, Keltner, who is trained in reading people's faces, has studied photos of moral heroes like Gandhi and the Dalai Lama and found that they feature just such controlled smiles and averted eyes. In his book, Born to be Good, Keltner even says that if he had to choose his mate by asking a single question at a speed dating event, the question he would choose is, what was your last embarrassing experience? Then he would watch very carefully for lip presses, blushing, and averted eyes. The elements of the embarrassment are fleeting statements the individual makes about his or her respect for the judgment of others, he writes. Embarrassment reveals how much the individual cares about the rules that bind us to one another. In other words, you want to make sure that your spouse cares what other people think. It's better to mind too much than to mind too little. No matter how great the benefits of blushing, the phenomenon of high sensitivity raises an obvious question. How did the highly sensitive manage to survive the harsh sorting out process of evolution? If the bold and aggressive generally prevail, as it sometimes seems, why were the sensitive not selected out of the human population thousands of years ago, like tree frogs colored orange? For you may, like the protagonist of the Long, Long Dances, be moved more deeply than the next person by the opening chords of a Schubert impromptu, and you may flinch more than others at the smashing of bone and flesh, and you may have been the sort of child who squirmed horribly when you thought you'd broken someone's toy. But evolution doesn't reward such things. Or does it? Elaine Aron has an idea about this. She believes that high sensitivity was not itself selected for, but rather the careful, reflective style that tends to accompany it. The type that is sensitive or reactive would reflect a strategy of observing carefully before acting, she writes, thus avoiding dangers, failures, and wasted energy, which would require a nervous system specially designed to observe and detect subtle differences. It is a strategy of betting on a sure thing, or looking before you leap. In contrast, the active strategy of the other type is to be first, without complete information and with the attendant risks. The strategy of taking a long shot, because the early bird catches the worm, and opportunity only knocks once. In truth, many people Aron considers sensitive have some of the 27 attributes associated with the trait, but not all of them. Maybe they're sensitive to light and noise, but not to coffee or pain. Maybe they're not sensitive to anything sensory, but they're deep thinkers with a rich inner life. Maybe they're not even introverts. Only 70% of sensitive people are, according to Aron, while the other 30% are extroverts, although this group tends to report craving more downtime and solitude than your typical extrovert. This, speculates Aron, is because sensitivity arose as a byproduct of survival strategy, and you need only some, not all, of the traits to pull off the strategy effectively. There's a great deal of evidence for Aron's point of view. Evolutionary biologists once believed that every animal species evolved to fit an ecological niche, that there was one ideal set of behaviors for that niche, and that species members whose behavior deviated from that ideal would die off. But it turns out that it's not only humans that divide into those who watch and wait, and others who just do it. More than 100 species in the animal kingdom are organized in roughly this way. From fruit flies to house cats to mountain goats, from sunfish to bush baby primates to Eurasian titbirds, scientists have discovered that approximately 20% of the members of many species are slow to warm up, while the other 80% are fast types who venture forth boldly without noticing much of what's going on around them. Intriguingly, the percentage of infants in Kagan's lab who were born high reactive was also, you'll recall, about 20. If fast and slow animals had parties, writes the evolutionary biologist David Sloan Wilson, some of the fasts would bore everyone with their loud conversation, while others would mutter into their beer that they don't get any respect. Slow animals are best described as shy, sensitive types. They don't assert themselves, but they are observant and notice things that are invisible to the bullies. They are the writers and artists at the party who have interesting conversations out of earshot of the bullies. They are the inventors who figure out new ways to behave while the bullies steal their patents by copying their behavior. Once in a while, a newspaper or TV program runs a story about animal personalities, casting shy behavior as unseemly and bold behavior as attractive and admirable. That's our kind of fruit fly. But Wilson, like Aron, believes that both types of animals exist because they have radically different survival strategies, each of which pays off differently and at different times. This is what's known as the trade-off theory of evolution, in which a particular trait is neither all good nor all bad, but a mix of pros and cons whose survival value varies according to circumstance. Shy animals forage less often and widely for food, conserving energy, sticking to the sidelines, and surviving when predators come calling. Bolder animals sally forth, swallowed regularly by those farther up the food chain, but surviving when food is scarce and they need to assume more risk. When Wilson dropped metal traps into a pond full of pumpkin seed fish, an event, he says, must have seemed to the fish as unsettling as a flying saucer landing on Earth. The bold fish couldn't help but investigate, and rushed headlong into Wilson's traps. The shy fish hovered judiciously at the edge of the pond, making it impossible for Wilson to catch them. On the other hand, after Wilson succeeded in trapping both types of fish with an elaborate netting system and carrying them back to his lab, the bold fish acclimated quickly to their new environment and started eating a full 5 days earlier than did their shy brethren. "There is no single best animal personality," writes Wilson, "but rather a diversity of personalities maintained by natural selection." Another example of the trade-off theory of evolution is a species known as Trinidadian guppies. These guppies develop personalities with astonishing speed, in evolutionary terms, to suit the microclimates in which they live. Their natural predators are pike, but some guppy neighborhoods, upstream of a waterfall, for example, are pike-free. If you're a guppy who grew up in such a charmed locale, then chances are you have a bold and carefree personality, well suited to La Dolce Vita. In contrast, if your guppy family came from a bad neighborhood downstream from the waterfall, where pike cruise the waterways menacingly, then you probably have a much more circumspect style, just right for avoiding the bad guys. The interesting thing is that these differences are heritable, not learned, so that the offspring of bold guppies who move into bad neighborhoods inherit their parents' boldness, even though this puts them at a severe disadvantage compared to their vigilant peers. It doesn't take long for their genes to mutate, though, and descendants who manage to survive tend to be careful types. The same thing happens to vigilant guppies when the pike suddenly disappear. It takes about 20 years for their descendants to evolve into fish who act as if they haven't a care in the world. The trade-off theory seems to apply equally to humans. Scientists have found that nomads who inherited the form of a particular gene linked to extroversion, specifically to novelty-seeking, are better nourished than those without this version of the gene. But in settled populations, people with this same gene form have poorer nutrition. The same traits that make a nomad fierce enough to hunt and to defend livestock against raiders may hinder more sedentary activities like farming, selling goods at the market, or focusing at school. Or consider this trade-off. Human extroverts have more sex partners than introverts do, a boon to any species wanting to reproduce itself. But they commit more adultery and divorce more frequently, which is not a good thing for the children of all those couplings. Extroverts exercise more, but introverts suffer fewer accidents and traumatic injuries. Extroverts enjoy wider networks of social support, but commit more crimes. As Jung speculated almost a century ago about the two types, the one, extroversion, consists in a high rate of fertility, with low powers of defense and short duration of life for the single individual. The other, introversion, consists in equipping the individual with numerous means of self-preservation, plus a low fertility rate. The trade-off theory may even apply to entire species. Among evolutionary biologists, who tend to subscribe to the vision of lone individuals hell-bent on reproducing their own DNA, the idea that species include individuals whose traits promote group survival is hotly debated and, not long ago, could practically get you kicked out of the academy. But this view is slowly gaining acceptance. Some scientists even speculate that the evolutionary basis for traits like sensitivity is heightened compassion for the suffering of other members of one's species, especially one's family. But you don't have to go that far. As Aaron explains, it makes sense that animal groups depend on their sensitive members for survival. Suppose a herd of antelope has a few members who are constantly stopping their grazing to use their keen senses to watch for predators, she writes. Herds with such sensitive, watchful individuals would survive better and so continue to breed, and so continue to have some sensitive individuals born in the group. And why should it be any different for humans? We need our Eleanor Roosevelts, as surely as grazing herds depend on their sensitive antelopes. In addition to shy and bold animals, and to fast and slow ones, biologists sometimes speak of the hawk and dove members of a given species. Great tit birds, for example, some of whom are much more aggressive than others, often act like case studies in an international relations class. These birds feed on beech tree nuts, and in years when nuts are scarce, the hawkish female birds do better, just as you'd expect, because they're quick to challenge nut-eating competitors to a duel. But in seasons when there are plenty of beech nuts to go around, the female doves, who incidentally tend to make more attentive mothers, do better than the hawks, because the hawks waste time and bodily health getting into fights for no good reason. Male great tits, on the other hand, have the opposite pattern. This is because their main role in life is not to find food, but to defend territory. In years when food is scarce, so many of their fellow tit birds die of hunger that there's enough space for all. The hawkish males then fall into the same trap as their female comrades during nutty seasons. They brawl, squandering precious resources with each bloody battle. But in good years, when competition for nesting territory heats up, aggression pays for the hawkish male tit bird. During times of war or fear, the human equivalent of a bad nut season for female tit birds, it might seem that what we need most are aggressive, heroic types. But if our entire population consisted of warriors, there would be no one to notice, let alone battle, potentially deadly but far quieter threats like viral disease or climate change. Consider Vice President Al Gore's decades-long crusade to raise awareness of global warming. Gore is, by many accounts, an introvert. If you send an introvert into a reception or an event with 100 other people, he will emerge with less energy than he had going in, says a former aide. Gore needs a rest after an event. Gore acknowledges that his skills are not conducive to stumping and speech-making. Most people in politics draw energy from backslapping and shaking hands and all that, he has said. I draw energy from discussing ideas. But combine that passion for thought with attention to subtlety, both common characteristics of introverts, and you get a very powerful mix. In 1968, when Gore was a college student at Harvard, he took a class with an influential oceanographer who presented early evidence linking the burning of fossil fuels with the greenhouse effect. Gore's ears perked up. He tried to tell others what he knew, but he found that people wouldn't listen. It was as if they couldn't hear the alarm bells that rang so loudly in his ears. When I went to Congress in the middle of the 1970s, I helped organize the first hearings on global warming, he recalls in the Oscar-winning movie An Inconvenient Truth, a film whose most stirring action scenes involve the solitary figure of Gore wheeling his suitcase through a midnight airport. Gore seems genuinely puzzled that no one paid attention. I actually thought and believed that the story would be compelling enough to cause a real sea change in the way Congress reacted to that issue. I thought they would be startled, too, and they weren't. But if Gore had known then what we know now about Kagan's research and Aaron's, he might have been less surprised by his colleagues' reactions. He might even have used his insight into personality psychology to get them to listen. Congress, he could have safely assumed, is made up of some of the least sensitive people in the country, people who, if they'd been kids in one of Kagan's experiments, would have marched up to oddly attired clowns and strange ladies wearing gas masks without so much as a backward glance at their mothers. Remember Kagan's introverted Tom and extroverted Ralph? Well, Congress is full of Ralphs. It was designed for people like Ralph. Most of the Toms of the world do not want to spend their days planning campaigns and schmoozing with lobbyists. These Ralph-like congressmen can be wonderful people, exuberant, fearless, persuasive, but they're unlikely to feel alarmed by a photograph of a tiny crack in a distant glacier. They need more intense stimulation to get them to listen. which is why Gore finally got his message across when he teamed up with whiz-bang Hollywood types who could package his warning into the special effects-laden show that became An Inconvenient Truth. Gore also drew on his own strengths, using his natural focus and diligence to tirelessly promote the movie. He visited dozens of movie theaters across the country to meet with viewers and gave innumerable TV and radio interviews. On the subject of global warming, Gore has a clarity of voice that eluded him as a politician. For Gore, immersing himself in a complicated scientific puzzle comes naturally. Focusing on a single passion rather than tap dancing from subject to subject comes naturally. Even talking to crowds comes naturally when the topic is climate change. Gore on global warming has an easy charisma and connection with audience members that eluded him as a political candidate. That's because this mission, for him, is not about politics or personality. It's about the call of his conscience. It's about the survival of the planet, he says. Nobody is going to care who won or lost an election when the Earth is uninhabitable. If you're a sensitive sort, then you may be in the habit of pretending to be more of a politician and less cautious or single-mindedly focused than you actually are. But in this chapter, I'm asking you to rethink this view. Without people like you, we will, quite literally, drown. Back here at Walker Creek Ranch and the Gathering for Sensitive People, the extrovert ideal and its primacy of cool is turned upside down. If cool is low reactivity that predisposes a person to boldness or nonchalance, then the crowd that has come to meet Elaine Aron is deeply uncool. The atmosphere is startling simply because it's so unusual. It's something you might find at a yoga class or in a Buddhist monastery, except that here there's no unifying religion or worldview, only a shared temperament. It's easy to see this when Aron delivers her speech. She has long observed that when she speaks to groups of highly sensitive people, the room is more hushed and respectful than would be usual in a public gathering place, and this is true throughout her presentation. But it carries over all weekend. I've never heard so many after yous and thank yous as I do here. During meals, which are held at long communal tables in a summer camp-style, open-air cafeteria, people plunge hungrily into searching conversations. There's a lot of one-on-one discussion about intimate topics like childhood experiences and adult love lives, and social issues like health care and climate change. There's not much in the way of storytelling intended to entertain. People listen carefully to each other and respond thoughtfully. Aron has noted that sensitive people tend to speak softly because that's how they prefer others to communicate with them. In the rest of the world, observes Michelle, a web designer who leans forward as if bracing herself against an imaginary blast of wind, you make a statement and people may or may not discuss it. Here, you make a statement and someone says, "What does that mean?" And if you ask that question of someone else, they actually answer. It's not that there's no small talk, observes Strickland, the leader of the gathering. It's that it comes not at the beginning of conversations, but at the end. In most settings, people use small talk as a way of relaxing into a new relationship, and only once they're comfortable do they connect more seriously. Sensitive people seem to do the reverse. They enjoy small talk only after they've gone deep, says Strickland. When sensitive people are in environments that nurture their authenticity, they laugh and chit-chat just as much as anyone else. On the first night, we drift to our bedrooms, housed in a dorm-like building. I brace myself instinctively. Now is the time when I'll want to read or sleep, but will instead be called upon to have a pillow fight, summer camp, or play a loud and boring drinking game, college. But at Walker Creek Ranch, my roommate, a 27-year-old secretary with huge doe-like eyes and the ambition to become an author, is happy to spend the evening writing peacefully in her journal. I do the same. Of course, the weekend is not completely without tension. Some people are reserved to the point of appearing sullen. Sometimes the do-your-own-thing policy threatens to devolve into mutual loneliness as everyone goes their own separate ways. In fact, there is such a deficit of the social behavior we call cool that I begin thinking someone should be cracking jokes, stirring things up, handing out rum and cokes, shouldn't they? The truth is, as much as I crave breathing room for sensitive types, I enjoy hail fellows well met, too. I'm glad for the cool among us, and I miss them this weekend. I'm starting to speak so softly that I feel like I'm putting myself to sleep. I wonder if deep down the others feel this way, too. Tom, the software engineer and Abraham Lincoln look-alike, tells me of a former girlfriend who was always throwing open the doors of her house to friends and strangers. She was adventurous in every way. She loved new food, new sexual experiences, new people. It didn't work out between them. Tom eventually craved the company of a partner who would focus more on their relationship and less on the outside world, and he's happily married now to just such a woman. But he's glad for the time with his ex-girlfriend. As Tom talks, I think of how much I miss my husband, Ken, who's back home in New York, and not a sensitive type either, far from it. Sometimes this is frustrating. If something moves me to tears of empathy or anxiety, he'll be touched, but grow impatient if I stay that way too long. But I also know that his tougher attitude is good for me, and I find his company endlessly delightful. I love his effortless charm. I love that he never runs out of interesting things to say. I love how he pours his heart and soul into everything he does and everyone he loves, especially our family. But most of all, I love his way of expressing compassion. Ken may be aggressive, more aggressive in a week than I'll be in a lifetime, but he uses it on behalf of others. Before we met, he worked for the UN in war zones all over the world, where, among other things, he conducted prisoner of war and detainee release negotiations. He would march into fetid jails and face down camp commanders with machine guns strapped to their chests until they agreed to release young girls who'd committed no crime other than to be female and victims of rape. After many years on the job, he went home and wrote down what he'd witnessed, in books and articles that bristled with rage. He didn't write in the style of a sensitive person, and he made a lot of people angry. But he wrote like a person who cares, desperately. I thought that Walker Creek Ranch would make me long for a world of the highly sensitive, a world in which everyone speaks softly and no one carries a big stick. But instead, it reinforced my deeper yearning for balance. This balance, I think, is what Elaine Aron would say is our natural state of being, at least in Indo-European cultures like ours, which she observes have long been divided into warrior kings and priestly advisors, into the executive branch and the judicial branch, into bold and easy FDRs, and sensitive, conscientious Eleanor Roosevelts. Chapter 7. Why did Wall Street crash and Warren Buffett prosper? How introverts and extroverts think and process dopamine differently. Tocqueville saw that the life of constant action and decision, which was entailed by the democratic and businesslike character of American life, put a premium upon rough-and-ready habits of mind, quick decision, and the prompt seizure of opportunities, and that all this activity was not propitious for deliberation, elaboration, or precision in thought. Richard Hofstadter, in Anti-Intellectualism in America. Just after 7:30 a.m. on December 11, 2008, the year of the great stock market crash, Dr. Janice Dorn's phone rang. The markets had opened on the East Coast to another session of carnage. Housing prices were plummeting, credit markets were frozen, and GM teetered on the brink of bankruptcy. Dorn took the call from her bedroom, as she often does, wearing a headset and perched atop her green duvet. The room was decorated sparely. The most colorful thing in it was Dorn herself, who, with her flowing red hair, ivory skin, and trim frame, looks like a mature version of Lady Godiva. Dorn has a PhD in neuroscience, with a specialty in brain anatomy. She's also an MD trained in psychiatry, an active trader in the gold futures market, and a financial psychiatrist who has counseled an estimated 600 traders. "Hi, Janice," said the caller that morning, a confident-sounding man named Alan. Do you have time to talk? Dr. Dorn did not have time. A day trader who prides herself on being in and out of trading positions every half hour, she was eager to start trading. But Dorn heard a desperate note in Alan's voice. She agreed to take the call. Alan was a 60-year-old Midwesterner who struck Dorn as a salt-of-the-earth type, hard-working and loyal. He had the jovial and assertive manner of an extrovert, and he maintained his good cheer despite the story of disaster he proceeded to tell. Alan and his wife had worked all their lives and managed to sock away $1 million for retirement. But 4 months earlier, he'd gotten the idea that, despite having no experience in the markets, he should buy $100,000 worth of GM stock, based on reports that the U.S. government might bail out the auto industry. He was convinced it was a no-lose investment. After his trade went through, the media reported that the bailout might not happen after all. The market sold off GM, and the stock price fell. But Alan imagined the thrill of winning big. It felt so real he could taste it. He held firm. The stock fell again and again and kept dropping until finally Alan decided to sell at a big loss. There was worse to come. When the next news cycle suggested that the bailout would happen after all, Alan got excited all over again and invested another $100,000, buying more stock at the lower price. But the same thing happened. The bailout started looking uncertain. Alan reasoned. This word is in quotation marks because, according to Dorn, conscious reasoning had little to do with Alan's behavior. That the price couldn't go much lower. He held on, savoring the idea of how much fun he and his wife would have spending all the money he stood to make. Again, the stock went lower. When finally it hit $7 per share, Alan sold and bought yet again in a flush of exhilaration when he heard that the bailout might happen after all. By the time GM's stock price fell to $2 a share, Alan had lost $700,000, or 70% of his family nest egg. He was devastated. He asked Dorn if she could help recoup his losses. She could not. "It's gone," she told him. "You are never going to make that money back." He asked what he'd done wrong. Dorn had many ideas about that. As an amateur, Alan shouldn't have been trading in the first place, and he'd risked far too much money. He should have limited his exposure to 5% of his net worth, or $50,000. But the biggest problem may have been beyond Alan's control. Dorn believed he was experiencing an excess of something psychologists call reward sensitivity. A reward-sensitive person is highly motivated to seek rewards, from a promotion to a lottery jackpot to an enjoyable evening out with friends. Reward sensitivity motivates us to pursue goals like sex and money, social status and influence. It prompts us to climb ladders and reach for faraway branches in order to gather life's choicest fruits. But sometimes we are too sensitive to rewards. Reward sensitivity on overdrive gets people into all kinds of trouble. We can get so excited by the prospect of juicy prizes, like winning big in the stock market, that we take outsized risks and ignore obvious warning signals. Alan was presented with plenty of these signals, but was so animated by the prospect of winning big that he couldn't see them. Indeed, he fell into a classic pattern of reward sensitivity run amok. At exactly the moments when the warning signs suggested slowing down, he sped up, dumping money he couldn't afford to lose into a speculative series of trades. Financial history is full of examples of players accelerating when they should be breaking. Behavioral economists have long observed that executives buying companies can get so excited about beating out their competitors that they ignore signs that they're overpaying. This happens so frequently that it has a name: deal fever, followed by the winner's curse. The AOL-Time Warner merger, which wiped out $200 billion of Time Warner shareholder value, is a classic example. There were plenty of warnings that AOL's stock, which was the currency for the merger, was wildly overvalued. Yet Time Warner's directors approved the deal unanimously. I did it with as much or more excitement and enthusiasm as I did when I first made love some 42 years ago, exclaimed Ted Turner, one of those directors and the largest individual shareholder in the company. Ted Turner, it's better than sex, announced the New York Post the day after the deal was struck, a headline to which we'll return for its power to explain why smart people can sometimes be too reward sensitive.